It's lovely to be here in Santa Cruz. I feel very much at home. I have been a little apprehensive knowing the mood in the United States at the moment, knowing that anyone who criticises the government is thought to be unpatriotic. However, I don't really care. I'm a legal alien. I have a green card and I don't intend to lose it or end up in Guantanamo Bay, tried by a military tribunal. But I believe that this country stands for the best of everything, and that's speaking the truth. So I'm going to speak the truth, and I don't care what anyone thinks. I'll speak my truth. If I'm shown to be wrong, I'll change what I say, but I'll speak the truth loudly and clearly, for we are in grave danger. I happened to write this book 2 years ago, and the title is actually The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military-Industrial Complex. It was to be called George Bush's Military-Industrial Psychosis until September 11th, and then we had to change the title. I spent a lot of time researching it. The reason I wrote it, well, there are two reasons. There's a man called Scott Powell who kept hounding the hell out of me, my hound of heaven, saying, "You have to update Missile Envy," and I said, "No way." And then I met a man called Bruce Gagnon who told me that America was about to militarise space, and in fact they're involved in doing that already, and I didn't know that. I, like most of you, felt that when the Cold War ended, and we must credit ourselves for that, we helped to bring that about. Physicians for Social Responsibility went on national TV in Russia for 1 hour, unimpeded by ads, to speak about the medical consequences of nuclear war, and there was a man called Mikhail Gorbachev who watched that. And he became president, and his main focus was the issue of nuclear war and the prevention of that. Because of our influence there and a massive influence in this country, we helped to bring down the wall and end the Cold War. And when that happened, I thought, thank God. You know, we were so exhausted, all of us. So I went home to my garden and my grandchildren, and most of us just relaxed. What I didn't realise was that when Clinton got into power, and I've written about the history in this book, he didn't have the confidence to take on the military. He had smoked some dope, apparently, although he claims not to have inhaled, which was clearly not true. He didn't go to Vietnam, so he hadn't shown any military might or muscle, and apparently in this country to be president you have to have shown the ability to kill people. And I say that advisedly and carefully because I've got a very close friend who's an admiral, Jean LaRoque, who said that our mission in the military is to destroy property and kill people. So he didn't have the courage or the wisdom to take them on. After the Cold War ended, he appointed Les Aspin, who some of you will remember, who worked closely with Sam Nunn in the Senate. They were both big hawks. But he appointed Aspin to the head of the Nuclear Policy Review Committee. We've had a new one lately, and I'll go into that. And Aspin's attitude was, well, we don't need nuclear weapons now. Not that we ever did, but that the Soviet Union has disintegrated and we must get rid of nuclear weapons. Well, unfortunately, during that review, Aspin was the Secretary of Defence. He died. And there was a man called Ashton Carter, a very altruistic, fine young man, who was put in charge, to the dismay of the top brass in the military. He had a lot of reviews and investigations and committees. You know what they're like in Washington, committee after committee. And finally, the Joint Chiefs of Staff did him in. In fact, I've got a quote here. They called ash to the carpet. They carpeted him. And at the end, nothing changed. The weapons were still in place. And one senior general was heard to say, "When you're threatening our missiles," he said, "baby, you're threatening the family jewels." Now, there lies the pathology, because you all know what the family jewels are. The reason that there is this nuclear addiction in this country, and indeed the world at the moment, is not the numbers of weapons, the strategies, the tactics, the politics, the reviews, the committees. It's man's mind. And if a patient presents to me with a pruritic rash and I don't investigate that patient adequately and find that the patient is dying of cirrhosis of the liver or has Hodgkin's disease or another disease that can cause itchy rashes, and I don't find the cause of the rash but look at the symptom, I can't cure the patient. What we do when we count the numbers of weapons and argue about this treaty and that treaty and all this stuff is we're looking at the rash. We're not looking at the disease. And the disease is the pathology, the psychic pathology within the minds of the people who develop the weapons and the policies. Now, mind you, I've treated some of these people on their deathbed, or I've looked after them as their children have been dying of cystic fibrosis, and I find when push comes to shove, in extremis, these people admit what they were doing was wicked, but only in extremis. And it's amazing to me how they can live their lives doing these really wicked things, not examining their conscience. I also have to say at this point that I think there's a difference between men's and women's minds, and I'm not talking about the men in this audience, but there are some men to whom the hormone testosterone is quite toxic to their psyches. To their psyches. Whereas estrogen and progesterone on the whole, and I'm not talking about Maggie Thatcher who may have had an arenoblastoma which secretes testosterone, but normal women, estrogen and progesterone does have a different influence, and for those of you who've had children, you will know that that incredible nurturing feeling after you've had a baby. I felt I could have fed the whole world. And I had dinner parties and used to fall asleep in the soup because I was breastfeeding, but you know, the nurturing is amazing. And you know that when a woman has breast cancer and you treat them with testosterone, as we used to, they become quite aggressive intellectually and emotionally. And when a man has cirrhosis of the liver and can't metabolise his estrogen he normally produces and loses his testosterone, his skin softens, the body hair falls out and he becomes very sweet. So we know that there's a physiological difference. Now, I'm not including, of course, the majority of men in this, but I am including those to whom testosterone has a profoundly deleterious effect upon the psyche. First of all, I want to talk about the scientists. I don't know if you know, but in order for Clinton to get the non-proliferation treaty even looked at and accepted by this country, and it hasn't been ratified by the Senate, I think. Has it?
No.
No. That's because of Jesse Helms. He had to placate the scientists in the nuclear weapons lab, Lawrence Livermore, Los Alamos and Sandia. And he said to them, and they demanded that they continue with nuclear weapons research, development and testing, and then he could go ahead with the NPT. So he bribed them. So what they've done is set up a second Manhattan Project. The first was the biggest scientific project in the history of the human race, and it built three weapons at Los Alamos in a little boys' school under the direction of Robert Groves, General Groves, and Robert Oppenheimer. Was it Robert Groves? I think it was. Anyway, they made three bombs, and they worked fantastically hard and spent a huge amount of money. The first bomb was called Trinity, named after the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And if the bomb failed to work, the telegram to the president was to read, "It's a girl." But the bomb worked, and the telegram read, "It's a boy." And when Oppenheimer watched that bomb explode and realized he'd captured the energy inside the stars, he said, "I have become death, the destroyer of worlds," from the Bhagavad Gita. The second bomb was called Little Boy, dropped over Hiroshima. Flash, in an instant of a second, a little boy reaching up to catch a red dragonfly in his hand against the blue sky, a blinding flash, and he literally disappeared and left his shadow behind him on the pavement. And about 120,000 people were killed in that moment or died thereafter. Some people survived and escaped to the only Christian centre in Japan, thinking America would never bomb that. and they arrived 3 days later to receive the second bomb, Fat Man, which was dropped on Nagasaki. Altogether, about 200,000 people were killed. Thus began the nuclear age with genocide, conducted by this country. Often when I go to Los Alamos to demonstrations, there's a man there who always assaults me and accosts me and said, well, we stopped the war and we stopped our people dying. In fact, the Japanese were negotiating at that time a peace treaty with Russia for America, one. And two, Einstein had written to the president saying, Roosevelt, don't do it. He died before it happened. Truman went ahead and did it. And three, America could have said, we've got the most dreadful weapon. We're going to explode it on an island and you watch. But that was a human experiment, and those people, the survivors, are human guinea pigs called Hibakusha. And that's how we've learnt what the exposure of radiation does to us, and we've been able to calibrate our instruments accordingly so that you don't necessarily get leukemia from X-rays or cancer, although the risk is always there, and any dose of radiation adds to your risk of getting cancer. Now, these scientists at these labs have a sort of aura, a mystical aura, almost like the Lord of the Rings, and when they go to Congress, the Congress people are really scared of them because they've harnessed the most extraordinary power inside the stars that people don't understand, and they get anything they want. So they got money and they're spending more than they spent during the first Manhattan Project for the next 15 years. You didn't know that, did you? Designing, developing, testing, violating in spirit and word the complete test ban treaty. Not blowing them up, but testing them by computers. Oh, and they're doing subcritical tests, little amount of plutonium, with chemical explosives in the desert. But they're about to violate the complete test ban treaty, according to Bush, and do it properly. And they're preparing Nevada test site to do that now, and building new nuclear weapons. So the rest of the world looks at America and says, well, you're doing it, we'll do it too. So that produces lateral proliferation, like countries like Australia. We're building a new research reactor. I'm sure it's because they want to build a bomb. For years, Australian scientists and some politicians have wanted to build an Australian bomb to emulate Britain and also the United States. And so lateral proliferation is started, and you have to know that your country is a model, whether you like it or not, because of the advertising throughout the world for the rest of the world. So what the scientists are doing is really wicked, because there are no enemies. America has no enemies except a few mad, crazy people. And those people could attack Australia too. There are always crazy people in any society, and I'll go into that in a little while. The scientists' psychology is fascinating. When a scientist designs a bomb, he sleeps with the mechanisms in a little hut above the desert floor, and the bomb is underneath in the caverns because it's underground testing. The night before the test, the scientist sleeps with his bomb the night before the test. He's sleeping with death. He's sleeping with the death of life on the planet. It's like a racing car driver, always flirting with death, but his own death. But this person is flirting with the death of creation. They talk about having labour pains before the bombs exploded. They talk about giving birth to the bomb. This is all done by an anthropologist who studied the scientists. And afterwards they talk about postnatal depression. The bombs are human, they have a skin, and as they age they grow whiskers. And human beings are talked about in very mathematical terminology, you know, collateral damage and that sort of thing. So they humanise the bombs and dehumanise us. And it's a very fascinating situation. And as a physician, I always want to know why. Why do they build these dreadful things that can annihilate New York in a flash? And what do they think they're up to? And have they no conscience? Many of them, the Star Wars warriors, are young men. They find it very difficult to have relationships at all with people. They don't tend to have girlfriends. They drink an awful lot of Coke. They eat a lot of ice cream and they spend all day on their computers, virtually not communicating with anyone else. Those people are inappropriate to be doing what they're doing. They're very smart, obviously. They might need a little help to socialise. But we've got to stop them. So that's the first thing, and I won't go into the whole of the Manhattan Project number 2, but I've gone into it in detail here. They've got the universities involved all over the country, foreign students too, who are going to learn secrets that they probably shouldn't learn in this new age of terrorism, quotes unquote. So I won't go into all of that. Now, the next thing I learned was, as I studied the new Bush administration, his inauguration was paid for largely by Lockheed Martin, which is the largest military industrial complex in the world, that's eaten up, taken over, company after company, Martin Marietta and the like. It's a huge behemoth. You've got a branch of it near here. You've got to close it down. And you've got to use closing it down as an example to the whole nation that Lockheed Martin has to go out of business. At Bush's inauguration, they said to people, this is the first inauguration where you can ride a Brahmin bull or sit in the cockpit of a jet fighter. Because they had a jet fighter sitting there at the not the inauguration, but the party. You know, the party. And Trent Lott, who works for Lockheed Martin, really, I mean, he's one of the senior people in Congress, he had a Lott hop. You know, those hops they have. What is it called? The sock? What's it called? Those parties they have where they hop and... A sock hop. They had a Lott sock hop funded by Lockheed Martin because the aeroplanes that Lockheed Martin makes are made in Trent Lott's district. The money was inordinate that was spent on the inauguration. So Bush is a corporate president. Not that others haven't been, but this one is really very overt. Huge amounts of money were spent getting him elected. The military-industrial complex gave by a margin of 2-1 to the Republicans compared to the Democrats. The Democrats took money too. Lieberman, who seems like a nice fellow Democrat, he's a big-time hawk. He comes from Connecticut, one of the most militarised districts in the country. So you can't trust any of them. They're all bought and sold. They're corporate prostitutes. Except Barbara Lee. Except Norm Sanders. Except Dennis Kucinich. So you've got it, you know, the number you can count on two hands. That's all. Decent people in the Congress. The rest are bought and sold and have no right to be there because they don't represent you. Now, the people in the administration, Cheney ran Halliburton Oil Company, and under his tutelage, it went from a very sort of small oil company to being number 22 in the Pentagon list of top corporations that the Pentagon funds. He did a huge amount of work in Afghanistan, and he's friendly with the Bin Laden family, as is the Bush family. In fact, the Bush family entertained the Bin Laden family in Maine a year or two ago at their summer residence. Not Osama, but they're big into oil, the Bush company and Osama's family. So the ties run very deep. Cheney, who's really the president, who lives underground like a mole. What's that animal that appears at spring? He's a groundhog. He lives underground and he runs a secret government that's answerable to not the Congress or anyone else, and he appears for fundraisers and that's about all, but he is the president, let's be frank. His wife was on the board of Lockheed Martin for 20 years, handsomely paid. Rumsfeld. Hands up those who don't know who Rumsfeld is. Good, you're well, okay. You're little. You better watch the television. He's called the Secretary of Defence. He's actually the Secretary of War. Rumsfeld is a very scary man. I don't know how you feel when you watch him on television, but he really frightens me. He lies consistently. He's not telling the truth, but he's very charming. And he intimidates the press with "oh shucks" type humour, and they all sort of giggle in an embarrassed way. And I've not seen one person in the media who's had the courage to take him on full frontally and ask him an intelligent question, or if they do, to follow through and make sure he answers it. He has been called by Kissinger the most ruthless man he's ever known, including global potentates. The reason why is that he was Secretary of Defense under Ford. Kissinger was Secretary of State, and Kissinger was in Moscow trying to get the SALT I treaty through, I think, or SALT II, one of them. And Rumsfeld didn't like it. So in Kissinger's absence, he called together the National Security Council, brought in the Joint Chiefs, and they voted it down, and that was the end of that SALT treaty. And President Ford was absolutely furious, and he did it behind Ford's back. So this man can achieve anything. If he can do Kissinger in, he can do anyone in, including the planet. Now, his history is interesting. He is on the board, or is very close to a think tank. I like the way they call themselves, think tank. They think in tanks. Called the National Security Council, run by a man called Frank Gaffney, who's an aficionado of Star Wars who used to work with Reagan. Gaffney is almost, shall I say it, psychotic in terms of Star Wars. He'd do anything for it. And on his board sit members of Lockheed Martin, and they give an award every year called the Keeper of the Flame Award, which is sort of appropriate. They gave it 2 years ago to Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld conducted two committees and investigations into Star Wars, one of which was not true, said that it violated what the CIA predicted. They said America wouldn't be threatened by any missiles from any country for the next 15 years, except from the Soviet, you know, ex-Russia. China's got 20 missiles that can hit you. For 15 years at least. He then conducted an investigation which found, no, you'll be under threat within 5 years from rogue states like North Korea, whose majority of people are starving, like Iraq. Well, everyone hates, they call him Sodom Hussein. Bush's father used to call him Sodom. His name's Saddam. He's a bad man, but in fact, if you look at the way he's treated his people in the past, people mightn't like me saying this, but the two countries some time ago in the Middle East that had the lowest infant mortality and the highest literacy rate were Iraq and Libya. It's interesting, isn't it? Anyway, he's not a good man, and he's gassed the Kurds, as have the Turks. Turkey's really much more corrupt and dictatorial than Iraq, but Turkey's a friend because in a military sense she supports America. So it's North Korea, it's Iraq, and what's the other one? Iran. Yeah, well, she wasn't one of the rogue states initially, but she's become one because they have to choose a few in the axis of evil. None of these countries can hit America. And he talked about a nuclear Pearl Harbor in space. That was his term. So Rumsfeld is totally committed to Star Wars, and I'll go into this in a minute. Now, the man who's his icon in the Pentagon is a man aged 78 called Andy Marshall. Andy Marshall is a strange character. He hardly talks to anyone. Most people in the Pentagon don't like him. He's not practical. But he lives in his mind, and he's very committed to militarizing space. And he's become the mentor for Rumsfeld. And so the Star Wars plan was really drawn up by Andy Marshall, and I've gone into all of this in the book. What other people on the administration staff include Stephen Hadley, who drew up the foreign policy, or headed the Foreign Policy Committee during the Republican convention. He's from Lockheed Martin. And there are numerous others, too numerous to mention, who are mentioned in the book. The other think tank that's deeply involved in Star Wars is the Heritage Foundation. Hands up those of you who know what the Heritage Foundation is. Okay, it's a think tank, but it's not. It's an advertising agency for the corporations. On its board sit Lockheed Martin. It's funded by Hertz Rent-A-Car, Holiday Inns, Coors Beer, Reader's Digest, Ocean Spray Cranberries, you name it. And Scape, who's a very rich man, very, very, very right-wing. From the Heritage Foundation has come the idea of privatisation of everything, globalisation, the GATT Accord, WTO, and taking over the whole world by the transnationals. And that big government is really bad for you. I can remember in the 70s being interviewed by a pretty young thing at television, and she'd say, I was trying to talk about nuclear war and genes and mutations, she'd say, but isn't big government bad for us? And I'd say, where did you get that from? Government of the people, for the people, by the people, free medical care, free education, no unemployed people, no homeless people, no people who are hungry, bridges all fixed, mass transit systems, get the SUVs off the roads, alternative energy, solar power, wind power, on and on. That's what government should be about. Government should not be about representing corporations. I've stood at the Senate door as they come out of the chamber, Teddy Kennedy, Ed Muskie, all of them, and there are the lobbyists in their velvet jackets, green velvet jackets, ready to grab them by the hand and take them to a steak and mushrooms lunch, or take them to a hunting weekend shooting pheasants, or to the ball game. That's how Congress operates. I may say that when I was younger and premenopausal, every time I was in Washington lobbying, I got propositioned every single time. They told me I had beautiful eyes, and I said, no, this is a gene and this is an alpha particle, and would I have a stake for, you know, that sort of thing. So it's not a very good place at the moment, but it needs to be cleaned up by you people because it actually belongs to you. And your money is being stolen from you. They're spending almost $400 billion this coming year on weapons. Weapons. Weapons have one task. They kill. And in the Bible, it says, thou shalt not kill. I was here on September 11th. I had to talk to a huge forum of students at Eau Claire, Wisconsin, at the university. And I really didn't know how to approach them. I knew they were in great shock and grief, but it was a very big Christian area. So I got out the Bible and I looked at Luke and I said, now look, being a Christian doesn't mean going to church on Sundays. It doesn't mean going up to meet God when you die in the sky. It means living what Jesus taught. So I read to them from Luke. I read, love thine enemies. Do good to those who hate you. And they really took it in and were very silent. And that was the time that America had the opportunity to really care for the world and to grow up emotionally, psychologically and spiritually. And for a month I thought it was going to happen. But it wasn't going to happen under Bush and Rumsfeld and Cheney and the rest. So then they decided to kill, using the most monstrous weapons, apart from nuclear weapons, we've ever seen. Planes bombing from 40,000 feet in the air, huge numbers of bombs, not knowing who they kill. Thermobaric weapons, which explode with such a force, with a negative energy that literally sucks people's eyeballs out of their sockets and ruptures their lungs. Those are the bombs they've been using next to the caves, which may well, according to some seismologists, have initiated that earthquake they had recently where many people were killed. It's a very fragile seismological area. And now, with the new nuclear posture review, they're talking about actually using small nuclear weapons that are currently being designed and built by the nuclear weapons labs. So the firewall between very big conventional weapons, 5,000 tons of thermobaric weapon, and a 5-kiloton bomb or 5,000 small nuclear bunker buster, same power but radiation, the people in the Pentagon really don't see much difference. And once you get into nuclear weapons, that may be the end of the planet. I wrote in this book as a physician. See, I think human life is sacred. I've spent my life trying to save it and all other life. The 30 million other species that cohabit the planet with us. And I said that two hands found in a New York street holding each other, a black hand and a white hand, just that. He's the same as a baby lying in Afghanistan in a street with its head blown off. Thou shalt not kill. Vengeance begets vengeance. And as Gandhi said, an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. It's a primitive response to go and kill. It solves nothing and creates more terrorists and more anger and more grief and suffering and starvation and refugees. And it's wicked. What should have happened is the CIA, the FBI, the National Security Agency, Mossad, MI5, MI6, and the Russians could have worked together to go and find those characters and hunt them out in a clever way, because they are clever, and bring them to the International Court of Justice, which America hasn't really condoned, and try them like we tried the Nazis and Milosevic. And then, and only then, would justice have prevailed. So now terrorism is used as an excuse for killing, and they've got 60 more countries in which they think terrorists are hiding. But what are terrorists? People fighting for their freedom in Colombia? People fighting for their freedom in Peru against wicked dictators? People fighting in El Salvador, where 40,000 people are killed and a family of 14 families own El Salvador? People being killed in Guatemala when the CIA overturned one of the governments in 1974 and put in a wicked dictator called Arbenz, and the New York Times reported they throw babies up in the air and catch them on bayonets in Guatemala. Who are the terrorists? How do you define a terrorist? Yeah, what happened here was just unmentionable. They were clever though, weren't they? So how does a Star Wars anti-missile system stop an American civilian plane packed with civilians, or with civilians on board, and some men with box cutters costing $2 at the local store? But Bush says, Bush of course doesn't write his speeches, Cheney and Rumsfeld say, and Condoleezza Rice, that that's all the more reason why we have to have a Star Wars system. So there are five layers, and Lockheed Martin's involved in all of them. That's the lower layer called theatre missile defence, where if China launches a missile at Taiwan, Taiwan launches an anti-missile and they hit mid like two bullets hitting. It'll never work. All the scientists say it won't work, but it's terrifically good fun for the scientists and the military, and it makes an awful lot of money for Lockheed Martin because they can steal your money so you don't have free healthcare. These are the new robber barons. The Rockefellers have had their day. Now it's Lockheed Martin, TRW, Boeing and Raytheon. And it's your money. The next three layers are this. Russia's got 2,500 hydrogen bombs on hair trigger alert ready to go because Clinton didn't get rid of them, because Aspen died and the Joint Chiefs won the family jewels. And America's got 2,500. They've both got them, aimed at each other. In 1995, Norway launched an American missile with a weather satellite on top. The Russians picked up the radio waves from that, the telemetry, and said, oh my God, we're under attack, because America's policy still is, officially, to fight and win a nuclear war, which would create nuclear winter and the end of life on Earth. The Pentagon don't like nuclear winter. They don't know what to do about it, so they just ignore it. So the Russians thought they were under attack. For the first time ever, see, they pick up the big plume of fire from an infrared detector in a satellite, and they see the missile got, and they say, oh my God. So they really did think it was happening. So they opened the nuclear football, which is the nuclear weapons codes to launch the weapons. This is the first time it's ever happened in the history of the nuclear age in Russia. Yeltsin was sitting there, probably already had his bottle of vodka for breakfast, and he had his general standing over his shoulder. He's a very severe alcoholic. And they said, Mr. President, press that button. He had a 3-minute window of opportunity to launch before the weapons land, because the way you win a nuclear war is you land very accurate missiles on their missile silos before they get to press their button. You kill their missiles and you've won the war. Except if millions of people are killed, that's called collateral damage, and you don't worry about that. You've killed the missiles. If a few escape, your missile defence system wipes up the few missiles that escape. So missile defence system is actually about fighting and winning a thermonuclear war. That's what it's about. I described it here. So 3 minutes he had. At the last 10 seconds, the missile veered off course and they realised that in fact this was not a nuclear attack. We were 10 seconds from being vaporised. Every single town and city in this country with a population of 10,000 or more is targeted. Every university. There used to be 40 bombs targeted on Washington because there's such a redundancy of weapons. There are only 240 major cities in the Northern Hemisphere. 2,500 hydrogen bombs targeted on America. It could happen tonight. The Russian early warning system only works 8 hours a day because it's all going rusty. People steal the copper cables connecting their computers and melt the copper down because they're so poor over there. It's unbelievable what's happening. The Pentagon knows it. They don't do anything about it. So now how do you get these missiles? Well, there are 3 stages of a ballistic missile travelling 5,000 miles, intercontinental. The boost phase, going through the atmosphere, 10 seconds. The transit phase, about 25 minutes through space, and the terminal phase dropping here. Now, most Russian missiles and yours are MIRVed, multiple independent reentry vehicles, 10 bombs on one missile. So it's much more effective to get it in the boost phase where you get 10 bombs than wait till the transit phase when the missile drops away and the bus continues with its passengers in it, the bombs, Pentagon language, and then the passengers are dropped off at various intervals and land accurately on the missile silos. So if you get the bomb going through the boost phase, it's great. Except there's no time for human intervention, so the battle management computer has to make the decision. So the whole of life on Earth will be dependent upon a computer which can never be tested, except in the heat of the battle. And if you knock out 10 hydrogen bombs going through the atmosphere, each has 10 pounds of plutonium in it. 1 pound, hypothetically, can give everyone on Earth cancer. That's 100 pounds of plutonium. That's medically contraindicated to do such a ghastly thing. Now, if they go through space, you've got 10 targets, 10 bombs, and if you blow up Mylar balloons, they look just like tumbling bombs going through space. So you have 100 Mylar balloons and 10 bombs, and your missile, your kill vehicle, doesn't know the difference between a Mylar balloon and a bomb. Well, it might be a bit cooler because it picks up the temperatures, it's got a temperature sensor. So you heat the Mylar balloons or you cool the bombs so they both have the same temperature. I mean, it's very complex science and it's great fun. And then you can keep them in the terminal phase going through the atmosphere. So they're the 3 phases of missile defence, none of which will work. But it's going to violate the cornerstone of arms control, which is the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which George Bush has said, in his wisdom, he is going to violate in June. And that's the foundation upon which all nuclear arms control depends. And once that happens, Russia's going to say, you're going to build anti-missiles? We'll fix you. We'll supersaturate your system and we'll build thousands more weapons and you'll never get us. And China, she's only got 20 missiles or 18 that can hit you. She's not armed at all, hardly. China's very clever. She said she'll do it too. So it creates immediately a vertical nuclear arms race with Russia, America and China. And then the little countries say, well, you're going to do this too, and why are you just protecting America? What about us? How do you reckon the rest of the world feels? Well, I mean, you should be protected because you're America, right? But you're only 5% of the Earth's population. What about us in Australia? We've got the nerve centre of the Star Wars system in the middle of Australia at Pine Gap, the biggest CIA base in the world, which we've got to close down. So the little countries say, well, will build nuclear weapons too. So you get vertical proliferation and lateral proliferation. And I predict if this goes ahead that we'll have a nuclear war. How old are you?
23.
Before you're 40. Probably before you're 33. That's what Rumsfeld means. And Cheney. Well, Bush wouldn't probably realise. And Condoleezza Rice, Condi. And Lockheed Martin. And I've talked to men who make cruise missiles, and I said, but what about your children? And they look me straight in the face with eyes like stones, and they say, I'm making money. And I said, yeah, but what about your children growing up? Again, their eyes are like stone, and they say, I'm making money. And I think if your child got bruises all over it and started bleeding from the gums, and I did a blood picture and saw the blood was full of immature white blood cells and told you your child had leukemia, what would you do? It's a form of displacement activity. If you put rats in a cage and threaten them with a lethal situation, they run away and do something totally irrelevant. Then America's about to militarise space. That's the fifth layer of Star Wars, because you see, NASA for years has been mapping the planets, the moon and the asteroids for rare minerals. And they're going to put nuclear reactors up there and men and mine the minerals, you pay for it in your taxes, and bring them back and the corporations make the profit. But if they spend so much money in space, America's going to dominate space, and the plans are to fight war in space and from space down to Earth. So now Lockheed Martin and others are building anti-satellite weapons. We need satellites for our cell phones, for global communication, for global economy and the like. So they knock out other people's satellites. They're building laser beam weapons powered by nuclear reactors which will orbit the Earth. And they're going to wipe out cities in the flash of light. And quotes affect very many kills, millions of people. And they may, in fact, in their back pocket, have plans to have orbiting hydrogen bombs, because the kill vehicles won't work, the missile defence won't work, but the best thing to do is to blow up a nuclear weapon up there and it'll get everything. So that's what, if you get them in a corner, they say, well, yeah, actually, well, that's what we're really thinking. So I'm in Australia and I say to my grandson, Mickey, look, there's Southern Cross. Ooh, look. There's a hydrogen bomb. Space is a global commons. The moon is a global commons. According to UN treaties, we all own it. No country has a right to militarise it. But that's what they're doing, and they're building the equipment right now. And Lockheed Martin is into it up to its neck. Boeing, that makes planes, is into it up to its neck. TRW and Raytheon. The other chapter I write about is the nuclear war in Iraq, where they use depleted uranium weapons, about 800 tonnes. Uranium, you okay? You look wide awake. I'm sorry, it's complex. There are two sorts of uranium, 235, which is fissionable. When you dig uranium out of the ground, 235 is present in 0.7%. You enrich it to 3%, that's for nuclear power plants. 50% or more is for bombs. The Nagasaki bomb was a uranium bomb. All the stuff left behind is called depleted uranium, depleted of uranium-235, okay? It's 238. It has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. But it's good, because it's free. And it's lying all around this country, giving off radon gas, causing lung cancer, God knows, often to indigenous populations, because that's where they mine uranium. But it's 1.7 times more dense than lead, and when it hits a tank at high speed, it penetrates the tank. Except when it penetrates the tank, it burns, producing tiny little oxidized particles that can be inhaled into the terminal air passages. It's radioactive. It causes cancer. In Basra, where they used a lot of these weapons, the children are playing on the desert floor with these radioactive shells. The incidence of cancer in children in Basra has gone up 6 times. And congenital malformations has doubled. So babies are being born with a single eye. They're being born anencephalic, with no brain, no vault of the skull, just a nubbin of a brainstem, so they suck, they sneeze, they cry, they cough, and they die in a week. And all sorts of other ghastly malformations, they've doubled. That's the tip of the iceberg for the rest of time for people in Iraq and Kuwait. America's taken no responsibility for this, and the sanctions have caused the pediatricians to despair because they can't get chemotherapeutic agents for their patients, or antibiotics, or radiotherapeutic instruments. Every month, 5,000 children die in Iraq. Since 1991, that war or massacre, 1.6 million people have died, half of them children. And they asked Madeleine Albright on one of the programs, do you think that's moral? She said, well, we think it's worth the price. Quotes in the book. Now they're going to bomb them again. And the people who really want to do it are really ultimate hawks. One is called Paul Wolfowitz. You read about him in the New York Times. He's in the book. And another is Richard Pearl, who worked with Reagan in the Pentagon, and they called him in the Pentagon the Prince of Darkness. And they are the main advisors to Rumsfeld. There's been a huge battle, almost nuclear, in the administration between the moderates, the State Department and Powell, and the hawks. Guess who's won? And Powell didn't want to go into Iraq, and the State Department thinks it's stupid. The rest of the world is in uproar. How many people are they going to kill? So why did Cheney go over to the Middle East? Oh, he didn't really go to fix that ghastly situation between the Jews and the Palestinians. He went to settle them down so it'll be okay if America goes and bombs Iraq. That's why he went. It was written about in the New York Times. I'm going to end by describing for you who haven't heard it before the medical effects of nuclear war just quickly, and then I'll give you hope. You know when you're listening to your radio and it gets interrupted and you hear whoo, this is just and a very deep male voice says, this is just a test of the emergency broadcasting system. This time imagine the weapons were launched in Russia by Putin by mistake or by a computer error. And you hear the message, but it says, this is an alert, we are under nuclear attack. You have 5 minutes to reach the nearest fallout shelter. You won't get there. The bomb's going to drop on San Francisco, because that's a big city, but you'll be targeted. You've got a university here, right? You're targeted. We could even use this theatre as the epicentre. It will come in at 20 times the speed of sound. You won't hear it. We won't know because we haven't got our radio on. And it will explode with the heat inside the centre of the sun and dig a crater 3/4 of a mile wide and 800 feet deep, turning this beautiful renovated theatre and the whole of downtown, everything, into radioactive fallout shot up in the mushroom cloud. 5 miles from here in all directions, everyone will be killed, but most will be vaporised, like that little boy leaving his shadow on the pavement behind him. 20 miles from here, everyone killed or terribly burnt, lying without friends or relatives. No doctors, because we're dead. No hospitals, because they've been destroyed. No syringes, but the White House is stockpiling huge quantities of morphia just in case there's a nuclear war. If you look at the bomb 50 miles out, the flash is so bright you'll be instantly blinded, like looking at the sun. And then the whole area will be engulfed in a firestorm of 3,000 square miles. Think about it from here. Sucking in winds of 500 miles an hour, sucking people out of buildings and turning them into missiles. Windows popcorning, shards of glass at 100 miles an hour, decapitating people. When it's finished, there'll be millions of bodies, animal and human. And as they decay in a radioactive environment, the bacteria we harbour will mutate and become more lethal. So all the diseases we once controlled, like polio and typhoid and plague and tetanus, will become rampant and epidemic, measles, diphtheria. We'll have to live underground for 6 months because the radiation will be so intense, but they think they'll use the old people to gather food because we won't live long enough to get our cancers. It takes 5-20 years to get a cancer from the fallout. But the food will be radioactive. All the water supplies destroyed, the sewage systems. And as Nikita Khrushchev once said, if there's a nuclear war, the living will envy the dead. And it'll be the end of Shakespeare. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. It'll be the end of Brahms. Brahms' Alto Rhapsody. It'll be the end of Beethoven's Ninth. It'll be the end of humanity and the end of most of creation, except the cockroaches will survive and the algae, some bacteria and viruses. And we're all set up, ready to go. And we're on alert on September the 11th for some time. Now, I'll tell you what I'm doing. You've got to read this book. There aren't enough books out there. There's going to be a list. You can write your names down. You have to learn it like I learnt Grey's Anatomy. If there is a war and I have to operate, I have to know where the ureter is. I have to know where the vessels are. I have to know the anatomy. You have to know this because you are now the physicians of the planet. You. And each one of you can be more powerful than the most powerful person who's ever lived. I'm setting up an institute. It's going to be called the Nuclear Policy Research Institute, NPRI, to take on the Heritage Foundation in the media. So when they go on and... when they go on and represent Lockheed Martin, I'm on to contradict them, or Dan Hirsch is on, or wonderful people who are really tops in this, all these areas I've discussed, the very best experts in the world, take on Rumsfeld. He won't ever go on alone again because we will insist that we're on to answer what they say. And it was Jefferson who said an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. We've done it once before. In 78, most people said better dead than red. Then we dropped the bomb on them and they said, oh, nuclear war is bad for our health. And a huge movement grew so that in 5 years, 80% of people opposed nuclear war and we ended the arms, well, we ended the Cold War. Now we have to finish our work. We haven't finished. Clinton didn't do it for us. We've got to do it. So all the millions of people who were involved before in the churches, the Catholic Church, they've got a lot to do now because they're in bad favour. So they can redeem themselves by doing, hey, saving the planet, you know. And the Methodists and the Presbyterians and the Anglicans and the Jewish religion and Islam and Muslims and everyone. What? Yeah, of course. Well, they were good. They stopped the MX. I went to see the Mormons and I said, you don't want to have the MX here. And they stopped it going to Utah. So they can do that too. All of them. Because this is God's work. What else could be? And the physicians and the educators and the teachers and the psychologists and the architects. I even had to address the morticians, their annual meeting, because they didn't want to embalm radioactive bodies. And I said, well, don't worry, you will be one yourself. But they passed a resolution against nuclear war, you know. Then I thought of an action, babies against the Pentagon. We can release hundreds of naked toddlers into the Senate chamber. And the senators can clean up the mess, you know, because these are the symbols of the future, these beautiful little babies. So we can go and see Senator Helms and change the baby's diaper on his table, you know, and say, Senator Helms. I mean, you need to let your imaginations fly. I need $1 million a year for the next 5 years, and I guarantee that we will close down all the nuclear reactors in this country, which are all nuclear targets now for terrorists, and we'll get rid of nuclear weapons globally because the world's ready for it. And it's called the trim tab factor. You have a huge ship and a huge rudder, and then built into that rudder is a little tiny rudder called the trim tab factor. You turn that and the whole ship of state turns. And I think the aphorism, in a dark time the eye begins to see, is perfect for now. And now we're ready to go again, right? All of us. And we're going to take it on and we'll finish our work in 5 years. So this kid lives to be 90. Stand up. That one. 12, finished.